Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Understanding the Paradox of Surviving Childhood Trauma, Techniques and Tools for Working with Suicidality and Dissociation by Joanne Zucchetto, Simone Jacobs, and Levick Johnson. Narrated by Levick Johnson. Preface. This book was written over the last 2 years, but it has taken much longer to formulate. It is a collaboration of three therapists, but the ideas expressed within are those of Joanne Zucchetto. Simone and Lee were just wise enough to recognize something special within Joanne and the therapeutic guidance she offered. It has been a tremendous challenge for all three of us to get to this point, and at times we didn't think we would make it. Not because of conflict between us, but because we had to fight our own internal doubts about believing we had something worth writing. But as Joanne says, we cannot ask our clients to do something we are not willing to do ourselves. Survivors of trauma are pretty good at identifying inauthenticity, and if we challenge them to do scary things, we must also be willing to do the same. So this book is our scary thing. None of this would have come to be if we had not worked for many years at the Center Post-Traumatic Disorders Program at the Psychiatric Institute of Washington. Many years ago, Christine Courtois, Joan Turkus, and Barry Cohen created a program of care for those with a history of childhood abuse and neglect. They worked hard within many constraints to provide a safe enough place for those struggling with the long-term effects of childhood trauma. The inpatient program at the center provided a place for those in acute crises who were stuck, hurting, and in need of intensive support. It provided a certain level of security within 24/7 care and a hard-working treatment team that included nurses, psychiatrists, social workers, psychologists, nurses' aides, art therapists, interns, and hospital administrators. By engaging in group therapies, individual therapies, medication management, and within the therapeutic milieu, patients worked through acute suicidal crises and found the courage to face their past. The outpatient day program at the center provided treatment for longer-term processing of trauma. Patients often stayed in the program for months at a time, sometimes longer. Through group therapy and art therapy, patients worked on processing their trauma narrative and exploring the relational devastation that is caused by growing up in an abusive home. It is in these settings that Joanne worked for many years and where Simone and Lee interned and then continued to work after graduation. This environment provided a unique opportunity to work with a great number of patients who often taught us more than we could learn from our ongoing training and reading. Most writers who address with sensitivity the distinctive needs of trauma survivors acknowledge that they learned what they know from their clients. We, too, have listened with a passionate curiosity, and we dedicate this book to all our teachers. In this book, you will find a discussion of suicidal behaviors being viewed as a coping strategy rather than just a problem that needs to be fixed. We highlight our ideas with stories of clients who have been able to go to the dark places that suicidality paradoxically protected them from. But we do want to make clear that this does not mean that suicidality should be taken lightly. Suicidality is serious and can be deadly. At no point should a therapist tell a client they don't really want to die, that they are just distracting themselves from a bigger problem. This isn't helpful and could easily escalate a delicate situation. We take any client who tells us they are suicidal very seriously. It only takes an impulse and access to the means to die for a suicidal thought to become a deadly action. Working with clients who feel suicidal requires training, experience, and sensitivity, as well as an ability to connect with a client and value what they think and feel. As we first started to talk about writing this book, we heard through the hospital community that a former patient had killed herself. The death of this patient affected us deeply, and we were filled with self-doubt about the appropriateness of discussing suicidality in any way that might be misconstrued. We sought the counsel of Rich Shevitz, who, after reading the preliminary ideas of the work that is presented here, said, "Well, Joanne, I can see you are coming out of the clinical closet." We felt Rich's statement acknowledged that it was a big step to go public with the ways we'd been doing therapy with trauma survivors. His encouragement has been tremendously helpful. We wanted to mention this suicide because no trauma therapist is immune to this possibility. Suicide is real, it causes real pain, and it is a risk every trauma therapist deals with, sometimes on a daily basis. This book is dedicated to those clients who choose every day to live, even when the will to live feels tenuous. This book is dedicated to those who gave up the fight, who for whatever reason on that day could no longer face their reality. But unlike some who see only the deep despair that must overwhelm the senses, we also see hope, because in the act of suicide is an act of hope. The hope for an end to the suffering, a hope for stillness, a hope for the absence of pain, a hope for something better for those they may leave behind. We wish for something better for them, and we aggressively advocate for such in this book and the work we do on a daily basis to change the meaning they bring to their experiences. But we also respect and honor those who could not continue. This book is also dedicated to the therapists who work tirelessly to provide support, encouragement, and healing to those who have survived the darkest of experiences. This work is hard and requires therapists to bring their whole selves into the room with clients who have been abused by those who should have loved them the most. This book is dedicated to those therapists who chose to do this work long before it was mainstream, who fought hard to give it prominence in the world of mental health and have lived to see their work realized. These therapists have listened and borne witness to personal atrocities that required them to hold steady and not instinctively, protectively turn away. This book is dedicated to our colleagues who became our friends and companions on this journey. Their words, their wisdom, and their stories are an intrinsic part of this book. We are thankful for their support, their insight, and their passionate dedication to working with survivors of trauma. We are particularly thankful for the support of Joan Turkus, Cornelia Tietke, Andy Morrow, Diane Carlson, and Sheila Cahill. Finally, this book is dedicated to our families and friends. They have supported and encouraged us from the first conversations about this book until its completion. They have given us their time, provided food, and calmed our anxiety as we chose to speak up, to be seen, and to be a part of the current conversation about trauma. Joanne would like Jim to know how much she appreciates his steadfast support and superb IT skills, and to thank Michael and Adam for their continuous encouragement. Simone would like to thank Sylvester, Janet, Rachel, and Hannah, who have been a constant source of support, comfort, and inspiration, and Kendall, who shared in the struggle that is writing. This book could not have been written without her support. Lee would like to thank Meg for her encouragement, as well as Eric and Eloise for being generous with their love and humor. We could not have taken this risk without them. Chapter 1, A Non-Pathologizing Approach to Trauma Treatment. A Non-Pathologizing Approach. About 2 years ago, 25 years into Joanne's career as a trauma therapist, she had a two-part session, morning and afternoon, with Annalise, a client on the inpatient trauma unit she worked on at the time. Annalise, an engaging woman in her early 40s, held a highly regarded professional job. Like all patients on the inpatient unit, Annalise was a survivor of childhood abuse and neglect. Starting at an early age, her father had sexually, physically, and emotionally abused her, while her mother had been passive and non-protective. Annalise left home after college and had no further contact with her parents, although she maintained limited contact with her siblings. She was recently separated from her husband, with whom she had two children. Her husband had been psychologically abusive to her, but she was very clear about him being a good father. She was in the middle of a difficult custody battle and in fear of losing her children. She had struggled emotionally over the past 5 years and had been hospitalized numerous times in general psychiatric wards. This was her first hospitalization in a trauma-focused program. Annalise was initially hospitalized for 2 months after a suicide attempt. Joanne was not Annalise's individual therapist during that stay, but they got to know one another because Annalise was an active participant in Joanne's inpatient group therapy. In preparation for discharge from her initial hospitalization, Annalise had completed discharge paperwork that had included a detailed safety plan. Less than a week after discharge, Annalise was readmitted to the inpatient unit after another suicide attempt, this one much more serious than the last. Her insurance company would not authorize another long stint in the hospital, and so the pressure was on the treatment team to help her create a safety plan that would actually ensure safety when she returned home. However, after weeks of intense efforts, the team remained concerned that the safety plan wouldn't hold. Joanne was asked if she would take the case, and she readily agreed. That morning, Annalise entered Joanne's office, waving the discharge papers, and she asked in a challenging and hostile way, "Is this what you're looking for?" Joanne responded in true New Yorker fashion, "I don't even want to look at them because you'd be bullshitting me, and I don't like it, and you don't like it either." Annalise smiled in the same way she had in group therapy when Joanne said something that got under her skin, and Joanne knew they had connected. Joanne continued, "You're going to have to do your own kind of plan." And from there, Annalise and Joanne had a discussion about how it was important for Annalise to feel that she had the power to make decisions for herself and tell her truth. Annalise became tearful and asked, "What should I do?" Joanne answered in a way she had never done before, "Write your kids a letter. Whether you die or not, I don't care what you say in it as long as it is what you feel." When Joanne and Annalise met again that afternoon, Annalise read out loud a beautiful letter she had written to her children. Her letter started as if she were going to end her life, but the more she wrote, the more she understood how much she loved her children, that she could never leave them, and that she would do anything to be there for them. Annalise wept as she read the letter, and she wept again when Joanne told her, "That letter is your safety plan, and you can discharge when you can honor it." Joanne continued, "What's in the way of honoring this letter to your children?" Annalise immediately replied, "I'm so afraid." Joanne asked, "Of losing your children?" She replied, "Of losing them, of the damage I might have done to them by my hospitalizations. I don't know if I can handle this fear." And so they talked about the intolerable fear of feeling loss and guilt. They talked about how Annalise had postponed the custody trial because she couldn't tolerate the possibility of being told she could not have custody of her children for a year, but could only be granted supervised visitation. They talked, and Annalise wept about the power her husband and the judge had over her, and they connected the dots to her past. Joanne said, "It's so understandable that this male power evokes feelings about the power your father had over you for your whole childhood, and it must feel impossible to separate past from present so you can make a decision that reflects who you are now." At this, Annalise looked right at Joanne and said, "You know, Joanne, there's something else. I really shouldn't have my children for the next year. I should really use this year to do therapy and stabilize." Joanne responded, "I think you're right. Not because I think you're a bad mother, quite the opposite, but because this is a marathon, not a sprint. You need this year to absorb the fact that your father was not the nice guy you thought he was, and that his treatment of you has had devastating effects. I'm impressed with your thinking, because you could say, I love my kids, I die for them, they're my heart. But you could land up dead with that narrow view that doesn't include the totality of who you are and what you need to heal. So there was a shift from Annalise feeling she was a victim of the court system and her husband to her being a victim of her father. Annalise talked about how in group therapy sessions, she felt that Joanne was always going there with patients and getting to the painful feelings underneath the behavior. Annalise was ambivalent about both wanting that and being fearful of what she would discover. Joanne took the focus off creating a safety plan for preventing another suicide attempt, a plan that would satisfy the treatment team, the hospital administration, and the insurance company, and put the focus on what was actually fueling Annalise's feeling unsafe. For the next few days, before she was discharged from the second admission, Annalise talked in groups about her fears of knowing more about her childhood, tolerating the shame of not fighting for full custody of her children, and knowing that when she felt suicidal, it was important to put words to what the suicidality was trying to tell her, and then use her support system to get help for those fears. 9 months after discharge, Annalise was in twice-weekly therapy with a trauma therapist and had not been hospitalized. She had given full custody of her children to their father and was seeing them on a weekly basis. The story of Annalise illustrates many of the themes in this book. When working with survivors of childhood abuse and neglect, symptoms and behaviors can get in the way of seeing the heart of the problem. Regardless of the diagnosis, the self-harm, the drug use, the eating disorders, the mood swings, the traumatic memories, the forgetting of memories, the nightmares, the relationship chaos, and all the other symptoms, at the heart is a small child who was hurt, afraid, betrayed, confused, and alone. Clients like Annalise, despite appearances, are not in touch with that little girl anymore. She's hidden, protected, kept safe from all the scary things that happened in her world. And built up around the little girl who was hurt is an intricately woven wall of defenses and distractions that not only stops anyone penetrating, but also keeps her as lonely and isolated in her pain as she was when she was a child. In this book, we illustrate how, by taking a step back from the smoke screens, the mirrored walls, and the landmines, we can help our clients reconnect with the child who was hurt and begin to honor not just what they survived, but how they survived. We demonstrate how coping strategies developed during childhood, such as suicidality, were used as a means to cover over the harsh reality that is growing up in a traumatizing household. Unconsciously, children like Annalise used suicidality as a means of survival, a distraction from knowing and feeling the hurt that was inflicted upon them day after day. Helping Annalise to connect the dots between the past and present allowed her to make sense of her behavior in the present that on the surface seemed irrational. And by connecting the dots, she was able to see through the eyes of the child who was hurt, thereby increasing her empathy, lessening her shame, and bringing a deeper understanding to her behaviors. This gave her the ability to candidly identify her needs and opened up the possibility of taking a risk, something she could never have safely done as a child. This book is about how to get under the defenses that present themselves in the treatment room, to see through the noise and the distractions, and look at the core issues. With survivors of childhood abuse and neglect, the noise is pretty loud, and the distractions are very effective, persistent, and sometimes scary, and at times seem impervious to change. In the chapters that follow, we explore how taking a non-pathologizing approach, which views symptoms and behaviors as important information about how a client is coping rather than something that needs to be eradicated, almost immediately changes the course of the conversation. We will do this by seeing through the eyes of the child who lived through the abuse, not through the eyes of the self-judging adult who is seeking treatment. Looking through the eyes of a child enables us to connect the dots between past and present, between feelings and knowledge, and between what is happening in the treatment room and what happened in their traumatizing home. Complex trauma. The focus of this book is not on theory, but how we put theory into practice. Our practice is rooted in theory, but serious inquiry into theory will require other works. For a brief overview, see Principles of Trauma Therapy by Briere and Scott. For an overview with a focus on the therapeutic relationship, see Phil Kinsler's book, Complex Psychological Trauma. For a more comprehensive overview of theories of treatment, see Treatment of Complex Trauma by Courtois and Ford. The clients we write about in this book are survivors of childhood abuse and neglect. That is, they experienced multiple traumas, usually within their home, over an extended period of time. For most of the clients we have worked with, the abuse and neglect were inflicted over the course of their childhoods, and for some, into adulthood. Many were physically or sexually abused. Nearly all had experienced some form of emotional abuse or neglect that was inflicted through verbal assaults and manipulation, or had experienced neglect by parents who were grossly negligent in attending to their emotional needs. As a result of this extensive childhood abuse and neglect, many of our clients developed symptoms such as depression, anxiety, suicidal behaviors, self-harm, or substance abuse problems. The effects of childhood trauma on physical and mental health are well documented. Large research studies, such as the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, showed that the higher the number of adverse experiences, such as abuse or neglect, death of a parent, etc., the higher the chances of having increased numbers of physical problems or developing unhealthy habits that result in physical ailments. The study noted that with each additional adverse experience in childhood, the likelihood of developing mental health problems rises, along with an increase in attempting suicide. Suicidality and self-harming behaviors, as well as the complex relational issues that are associated with having had adverse childhood experiences, are part of what makes working with survivors of complex childhood trauma a challenge. Our clinical work, as well as this book, is focused on those who have had many adverse childhood experiences, particularly within their own home. The majority of our clients have experienced what is often called attachment trauma. Attachment trauma is described by Allen as trauma that occurs in attachment relationships, in extreme various forms of abuse and blatant neglect. Such experience is traumatic insofar as it A. evokes extreme distress, namely fear and other unbearably painful emotional states, B. undermines the development of the capacity to regulate emotional distress, and C. compromises openness to interpersonal influence by virtue of engendering distrust in others' intentions. Attachment theory. In order to understand what attachment trauma is, we first need to understand a little about attachment theory. Attachment theory was developed by psychologist and psychiatrist John Bowlby to explain how essential the parent-child bond is for healthy child and adult development. Bowlby and others spent years researching and providing empirical evidence to back up these claims. The more Bowlby observed attachment, the more he realized its importance. He believed the bond was so crucial that he wrote a paper in the 1940s for the World Health Organization stating that the provision of mothering was as essential for a child's growth and development as proper diet and nutrition. He went on to explain that the service which mothers and fathers habitually render their children are so taken for granted that their magnitude is forgotten. In no other relationship do human beings place themselves so unreservedly and so continuously at the disposal of others. This holds true even with bad parents. We are in full agreement that as we lay out in the following chapters, parents are the main source of survival and solace in distress. The bond that is so critical that children will do almost anything, even paradoxically want to die, in order to keep that bond intact. The bond is so important because without it, children are alone in the world, orphans in their own families. The bond helps children feel safe, be soothed, and be cared for. The bond also has the power to teach children how to regulate emotions and provides the foundations for forming cognitive structures. The child learns how to connect with and relate to other people within this bond, and the experience becomes internalized, remaining in place into adulthood. Thus, attachment has far-reaching consequences. In a series of experiments, developmental psychologist Mary Ainsworth devised a way to study the attachment bond in action by observing parents with their children. As it currently stands, there are four basic categories of attachment. In the first category, parents who provide good enough parenting generally create what is called a secure attachment. Parents of children with secure attachment are attentive enough to the needs of their child. They are a safe haven in times of trouble, a protection from potential predators, and a source of predictable stability when their child is afraid. Attachment provides more than physical protection. It is critical that the parent also be emotionally attentive, providing soothing and comforting when their child is in distress. When a child feels protected, they learn how to regulate their emotional experiences, which in turn helps in the formulation of healthy cognitive structures. From this place of stability, children are able to be curious about the world, and they grow into adulthood with a sense of the world being a mostly trustworthy place. There are three other styles of attachment which fall into the range of insecure attachment. Under this category of insecure attachment are children with parents who have an avoidant attachment style. These children don't turn to their parents in distress. They instead lean away from them. It may appear on the surface that these children don't need their parents for comfort or support, but they have learned not to depend on their parents as a source of soothing in distress because the parents are not available or may be rejecting. Children carry these experiences into adulthood, often having difficulty expressing their feelings and having problems finding, creating, or tolerating intimacy. Also under the category of insecure attachment are children with ambivalently attached parents. These are children who are distressed when their parents leave, but also don't appear to be soothed when their parents return. On the one hand, they may be very clingy, but on the other hand, when comfort is offered by the parent, the child is not soothed. The final attachment style in the category of insecure attachment is disorganized attachment. This style of attachment is most often found in children of mothers who consistently turn away when their child is in distress. Children with disorganized attachment show a mixture of attachment styles, at times avoidant and at times ambivalent, and at times it may seem as if they are securely attached. Children with disorganized attachment were observed to lack observable goals, intentions, or explanations. For example, contradictory sequences or simultaneous behavioral displays, incomplete interrupted movements, stereotypies, freezing or stilling, direct indications of fear or apprehension of parent, confusion, disorientation. Most characteristic is a lack of coherent attachment strategy, despite the fact that the baby may reveal the underlying patterns of organized attachment. These children try any and all techniques in order to elicit an attachment response from their caregiver. This category is most often associated with a child who will crawl backwards toward the parent in an attempt to be close, but is uncertain of the response they will receive. Attachment theory is important because it concerns the central role that parents play in the development of healthy, securely attached children who grow up.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?